All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a CW-2 helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. We want to welcome you to our program today. I'm really excited because we're going to be talking helicopters and helicopter rescues and all sorts of stories about helicopters. So all you rotor heads out there, just tune in, notify all your friends. We're going to be talking with Phil Marshall, who was a medevac pilot in Vietnam, and about his series of books. He's got about 12 of them, at least, that talk about helicopter rescues in Vietnam. So we're really excited to talk with Phil later on and make sure that you all tune in. Right now, I want to make sure that we thank everybody that supports Veterans Radio. We couldn't do it without you. Number one would be Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans is a law firm specializing in veterans' disability claims. For more information, go to their website. That's legalhelpforveterans.com, or you can give them a call at 800-693-4800. We also want to thank the National Veterans Business Development Council, or NVBDC. The NVBDC's main purpose is to certify that a veteran-owned business is actually that, veteran-owned. This can be very important for veteran-owned businesses and companies that want to do business with the government and with veteran-friendly corporations. So to find out more information about becoming a member of the NVBDC, give them a call at 888-237-8434. That's 888-237-8434, or you can go to their website. That's nvbdc.org. We also want to thank the Eisenhower Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The Eisenhower Center is an in-house facility for treatment of veterans and anyone else who has suffered from a post-traumatic syndrome, any sort of traumatic brain injury, concussion, anxiety, depression, or suspected CTE. They have a special program that they started a while ago called After the Impact Program that provides rehab for veterans, first responders, and professional athletes through a 30 to 90 day evidence-based treatment program. For more information, you can contact them at EisenhowerCenter.com. Should be noted that Eisenhower Center is hiring right now, and so we encourage you to go to that website, EisenhowerCenter.com/HR, and see if there's something that you might be able to willing to do or some way you can help them out. Or you could give them a call at 734-677-0070. That's the Eisenhower Center. And the last is our Vet Biz Central. And this is a part of the Veteran Business Outreach Center division, I guess you could say, of the United States Small Business Administration, specializing in helping out business veterans' businesses. And they are located up in Flint, and they handle the Vet Biz Central is for Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana. They put on all sorts of webinars and seminars for veterans who are attempting to start their businesses or to grow their businesses. They have entrepreneurial training, education, mentoring, counseling, how to write a business plan, how to go find funding, all sorts of things. So we encourage you to check them out. That's vetbizcentral.com. And their phone number is 810-767-8387. And I would be very remiss if I did not mention our local veteran service organizations that also help us out here at Veterans Radio. And that would be American Legion Post 46 of Ann Arbor, Veterans of Foreign War Post 423, also of Ann Arbor, and finally the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Post 310, all of Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thank you, men and women of those organizations. We could not do our job without you. Well, it's that time of year again. It's October, and October means the beginning of Toys for Tots. And Toys for Tots is in their 73rd year, which I think is awesome. The Toys for Tots program is sponsored by the United States Marine Corps. I can't do the hoo-yah because I'm not a Marine. Created in 1947 and expanded nationwide in 1948, the United States Marine Corps Reserve Toys for Tots program is an official activity of the United States Marine Corps and it is the Marine Corps' premier community action program. From 1947 through 2019, the United States Marines have distributed over 584 million toys to over 265 million less fortunate children. Today, Toys for Tots is the nation's flagship Christmas charitable cause, with local Toys for Tots campaign conducted from October 1st through December each year in over 800 local communities throughout the nation. We encourage you to go to toysfortots.org. It is a IRS-recognized 501c3 non-for-profit charity. And find out more information. And I've got an interview with the president, I guess he is right now. He's the head of the Toys for Tots organization. And this is Colonel, United States Marine Corps, retired Ted Migs Sylvester. So, Derek, if you could play that interview, that would be great right now.
This Christmas, Toys for Tots celebrates over 70 years of delivering a message of hope to America's less fortunate children. In 1947, one Marine unit delivered 5,000 toys. Today, Marines will provide toys and books to 7 million children in over 800 communities nationwide. Over 15 million children live in poverty in the United States, and nearly all risk waking up Christmas morning without a gift under their tree. Thousands of Marines and volunteers aim to change that. Lieutenant General Pete Osmond, President and CEO of the Marine Toys for Tots Foundation, has more.
Folks, Marine Toys for Tots really need your support this year. Through the gift of a new toy or a cash donation, you can help bring the joy of Christmas and send that message of hope to our nation's less fortunate children.
Simply drop your favorite toy in a Toys for Tots collection bin or make an online donation. Please go to www.toysfortots.org for more information.
Okay, that's toysfortots.org. We encourage you to go to their website. They will be starting to collect toys again. They're also looking for donations, of course, and during a pandemic, it's kind of going to be a more difficult situation to get to their collection boxes, but we encourage you to find out all that you can. And we're hoping that over the next couple of months, we will have representatives from the Marine Corps Reserves and to be on the program to give us kind of an update of what is going on with our Toys for Tots program this year. Okay, we're going to start getting our rotors going. We're going to start pulling pitch and taking off here pretty quickly. We're going to take a real quick break, and when we come back, our guest is going to be Phil Marshall. And Phil was a medevac pilot in Vietnam in 1969. His call sign was DMZ Dust Off 711. He was based out of Camp Evans in Quang Tri with a 237th Medical Detachment Helicopter Ambulance. This was the northernmost dust-off unit. Phil has written, I've lost count already, but at least 14 or 15 books that I can find about being a dust-off pilot and also about all of the various rescues that occurred in Vietnam. His latest volume, number 12, is Helicopter Rescues in Vietnam, the True Stories of Daring Helicopter Rescues as Told by the Men Who Flew Them. So stay tuned, put on your headsets, get some popcorn, whatever it is that you need, and we'll be right back with Phil Marshall right here on the show.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
The joy of living is in the giving.
Hello there, this is Nat King Cole wishing you all a happy and a merry Christmas and asking that you remember our less fortunate children by giving Toys for Tots.
As we can fly as high as is needed to stay out of the range of small arms fire. This is Dale Thronberry again with Veterans Radio, and as I mentioned earlier on, we're really excited to have Phil Marshall on our program today. He was a warrant officer helicopter pilot, as was I, and we were in country at the same time, just at different ends of the country. So, Phil, I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio.
Thanks very much, Dale.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you finally. We want to thank our friend Dwight Zimmerman for connecting us. Dwight is with the Military Writers Society of America, and he knew that I would be really interested in these books, and I'm so shocked that I hadn't heard about them before. How did you get involved in writing all these stories?
I wanted to honor the 15 men in my unit that didn't make a home to their families, and I knew that we had some rather unusual and memorable rescue missions in the 237th. So I put the book together, not knowing if I would even sell 14 copies, let alone have 14 volumes. But loaned copies of the book to friends who always had enjoyed hearing the stories, non-Vietnam veterans. And they said, wow, these are cool. You got any more? And I go, well, yeah, there's thousands of them out there. And it just started the snowball rolling. And I'm working on the 15th book. But all the books have at least 20 missions. They're all true. Some of them are just absolutely incredible. I sent a copy of a book to an acquaintance that flew Chinooks in Afghanistan. And his comment was, if I didn't fly in combat myself, I wouldn't believe half these stories. But they're all absolutely true. They're not embellished. And they're either told by the people who actually participated or for the stories with unhappy endings, those that were there and can provide me with the details and allows me to honor the men, the other men who didn't make it back, not only the ones in my unit.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, some of these stories are just so mind-boggling, and even though I was there and you were there, and you wonder how they got out of, you know, the messes that they would get into periodically.
Absolutely.
Because
yeah.
You know, one of the mantras of being a helicopter pilot, I think probably anywhere when you're in the military, if that is one of our people were hurt, we went to get him. We didn't even think twice. In fact, there's a really kind of a cute little article about the idiots in the front of the
I have guys contribute stuff to me that just comes out of the blue. And if you want to talk about that one a little bit, it's pretty funny.
It was. I have to find it again. I can't remember what page it was on.
Clear in the back of 12.
Okay. I will look it. But anyway, it just talks about that these poor door gunners and crew chiefs that were in the back of the aircraft, you know, kind of, unfortunately, they were on the, you know, it's like being a kid in your parents' car on vacation.
Yeah,
they
didn't have any choice in the matter. No, I shouldn't say they didn't, but, you know, sometimes, as you well know, things would come up for a vote, so to speak. You know, what do you think, guys? Should we do it? And it was always, yes, go.
Right. And so they talk about in this about the pilots and about them, you know, making those decisions. And it's, as I mentioned earlier on, I just thought it was so important that we all had the mentality was, here it is, the two crazy bastards up front.
I'm glad you could say the word.
I don't know. I'm looking at my controller here to say, don't do that. I think it's lightened up a little bit here. But it was written by Mike Vaughn, and I'm assuming he must have been a crew chief or a door gunner.
He was a crew chief, yes.
Okay. And he says, I remember times when our crew would be flying along, just minding our own business on some ash and trash mission. That meant just a regular resupply mission. And suddenly there was a call for a dust off or somebody needed to be picked up in a hot LZ. And, you know, do we continue flying along on a relatively safe ash and trash mission? Well, no, because the two crazy people up front have volunteered our crew for the dust off or the, you know, the extraction. And that was kind of the way that it was. It was.
That was our job.
That's exactly what it was. It was our job was. And one of your other stories, you had it was the Charles Simmons story. And I want to talk about that in a little bit later. But here,
sure.
You know, the motto of being in Vietnam is you either de-roast or you died.
Yeah.
And the de-roast was that's the date of estimated return to stateside. And of course, we know what the other one meant. But let's do get into these stories a little bit. I wanted to talk about the ones at the beginning. I was going to say it was mission number 2 in this volume, and it talks about the I Drang Valley and some of the misconceptions of what actually occurred there. And I'm going to let you tell a little bit of that story. I had the privilege of talking with Hal Moore about his book and with Joe Galloway and you know, got another version of some of these stories. So let's talk about the misconceptions.
Sure. Well, of course, the Battle of the Adrian Valley was the basis of the movie We Were Soldiers Once with Mel Gibson. And all of us dust off pilots, Medevac, 1st Cav, 15th Medical Battalion, 1st Cav Medevac, we were all upset at the way the dust off was portrayed in the movie, that the dust off refused to go in. Well, as it turns out, with a lot of research from the 15th Med historian, Terry McCarl, that higher-ups told dust off, or Medevac in this case, that you won't go in. They didn't have hardly any extra aircraft, any extra crew. The mission was almost surely going to end in disaster. And so higher-ups said, you won't go in. So Medevac had to refuse the mission. Well, that, not knowing where that came from, the ground troops, Hal Moore in particular, thought that the dust off was just refusing to go in. So the slicks, guys, names are escaping me right now. The one, the Medal of Honor, Freeman, and else
Freeman
was it?
Freeman and Crandall.
Bruce Crandall. They went in and pulled out like close to 100 wounded under intense enemy fire. Both awarded the Medal of Honor, which they absolutely earned. But again, the basis was that the dust off, the Medevac refused, which we never did. I never refused a mission. Whether I was co-pilot or pilot, it was you go. And so, again, with a lot of research from Terry McCarl and a lot of input from Medevac pilots, 15th Med Medevac pilots during that battle and in the unit at the time, said, no, we weren't allowed to. We were specifically told, you will not fly that mission. So that was where that came from. And again, it's really been upsetting to see the popularity of the movie and the book and us come off in a bad light.
Well, I think it should also be pointed out to our audience that this occurred in 1965, right?
Right. Yep. This was the first major battle of the war.
There weren't that many helicopters in Vietnam.
Well, and at least not huge, that, no.
Am I right?
I'm sorry. I think you cut out.
I said there weren't that many helicopters in Vietnam.
A lot of them had maintenance problems and were hard to keep in the air.
Right. I mean, they hadn't gotten into the we weren't even up to a 500,000 men yet serving in Vietnam. So, I mean, that's just another thing. And later on, as the battle continued, because this was not, you know, just a one-day battle. This thing went on for 3 or 4 days. Medevacs were flying in and out of there eventually.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, they once things calmed down a little bit, then they didn't have to land under intense enemy fire. So higher up said, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think it's interesting, and I want to tell our audience this, you know, that maybe are not familiar with Medevacs, is that you guys, you didn't have any weapons on board.
No. 15th Med, Medevac, they eventually put door guns on, but when they were had to refuse the mission, they did not have door guns. But then about a year later, they put them on. But of course, the Geneva Convention says that we couldn't carry offensive weapons as air ambulance. Medevac said, though, we're going to put them in, and it's preventive medicine. So, you know, you can take that as you want. But my understanding is that the North Vietnam, Viet Cong, did not sign the Geneva Convention. So they were shooting at the Red Cross. They got they had a medal and a $500 reward, piastres, whatever, for shooting down any American helicopter.
Right. And you guys had such a nice big target on it anyway.
Yeah. They did pretty good sometimes.
But the helicopter itself, machine. I mean, it could come down and look like Swiss cheese sometimes.
We were three times as more vulnerable than the average average helicopter in Vietnam. But, you know, why are we more vulnerable? Well, we're going in, somebody's wounded. We're going in to pick them up. That means there's bad guys there.
Right. There are bad guys. And a lot of times you didn't have gun support going into you, you know, as we did when we would go do extractions and so forth.
Yeah, rarely did we have guns because they were covering you guys. Yeah, we you know, you had some planning. You had some planning before most of your missions. We did.
Right, yeah.
The horn goes off and we're gone. And if we can marry up with some guns, great. If they're already there, great. But I flew for 4.5 months. I was wounded on a night insecure medevac. But in those 4.5 months, I can count on one hand the number of times we had guns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hey, well, you mentioned that your tour was cut short. What happened with you?
We had three seriously wounded 101st troopers just a couple of clicks south of the DMZ. It was at night. And one guy had a sucking chest wound. We knew that he'd not make it till morning. So, of course, we went, no question. And the bad guys let me get in, let me get my three wounded on board, and then they opened up on me as we came out of the LZ. And I took one round in the arm, which severed some nerves, and that was enough to send me home. But I was aircraft commander for 4 days. I proved my worth, but I didn't have the chance to, use it very much.
Oh, that's a sad story after only 4 days, because aircraft commander was the goal of all pilots.
Oh, the epitome. Yeah. Once you made aircraft commander, you were hot stuff for sure.
At least for a little while.
Yeah,
and then you,
for 4 days.
And then you came home and nobody cared. but you came home and you were a TAC officer.
Yeah, how'd you know that?
I read. I don't know.
Okay,
I might have run. No,
okay.
I was already out of. I was out of flight school when you came back. But to our audience, I have to explain. TAC officer is sort of like a drill sergeant for the warrant officer candidates. The walks.
Yeah, drill sergeant with bars. And I loved every minute of it.
Yeah. Which hat? What
really
hat were you? What color were you up there?
I was doing some good.
What color were you up there at Fort Walters?
We were white hats. 10th walk was where I was attacked.
Okay, I was in the first one. I was a red hat.
But,
okay. unfortunately, nobody liked TAC officers because it was their goal to make sure that we could actually become pilots and officers.
Yeah.
And so they did everything they could to seem like to discourage us in that goal. But
well, what it was is what I learned later. Of course, I knew it going in, but towards the end of the class, first class that I had, the fellow says, can I speak to you frankly, sir? And I said, yeah, what do you want? And he says, we know you can't touch us. We know you can't hurt us or anything, but why do you have to yell at us? Why do you have to do this and that and the other? And I said, because when somebody's shooting at you, you better make the right decision instantly without even thinking. And if you can't do that with me, knowing that I can't touch you, that I can't hurt you, you're not going to be a helicopter pilot. And he says, I never thought of that. And I said, that's why you're you and I'm me.
That is very true. I think if we had taken the time to learn what our TAC officers had done, it's like when I came back and became an instructor pilot, and I found out that all the instructor pilots that I had, you know, 1, 2, 3 tours and so on and so forth, in their background. It was so helpful, of course, at that time. Well, I'm glad that you were able to come back, and you continued working in aviation, didn't you?
Well, I was in the Ohio Guard for about 4 years, but my career was motorcycle dealership. But then once I retired, I became involved with American Huey 369 in Peru, Indiana, and where we've restored 3 Vietnam Hueys back to flight, and we're finishing up on a 4th one.
Well, while we've got you on that topic, let's talk about a little bit more about the American Huey 369 organization. You mentioned that you have you've restored 3 Hueys so far. Are they all D models or gunships, or what have you got?
Well, we've got an H model dust-off bird that flew with a 498 dust-off in Southern Ninth Corps. Then we've got a Slick with the door guns that was with the Thunderbirds, Warrior 1-1. And then our real pride and joy is a B-model gunship that flew for 6 years in Vietnam when the average Huey only lasted 6 months. And it escorted Crandall and Freeman into the Iodrang Valley when they were awarded their Medal of Honor. So that aircraft has an incredible history. We were told it wasn't feasible. Financially feasible to restore it, But when we realized the history of it, and we said, no, that we're going to restore it. And then, ironically, the Slick Warrior 1-1 was a medevac for 15th Med during the Iodrang Valley. So we've got two very historic aircraft just simply by chance. It's just been incredible to, and an honor to be flying those aircraft again. And then we've got another H model that will be our VIP bird. It was donated to us, and it's in perfectly good flyable condition. We just got to make sure the FAA puts their blessing on it.
All right. Yes. And people can, you go around the country. I know you're around the Midwest quite a bit, giving rides to people at different veterans outings and events and so forth. Where is American Huey 369 located?
Well, we're in Peru, Indiana, which is about an hour drive north of Indianapolis. Normally, we're in Indiana and surrounding states, but we've flown to Las Vegas, we've flown to Louisiana, Connecticut, and Canada, but one time or another. But mostly, we're in the Midwest. We usually do 15 to 18 events every summer, and for we're a 501c3 charitable organization. So for a $100 donation, you get a flight in a Huey with the doors open. Now, you can't sit on the floor anymore. We got to have to put you in seats and seat belts. But it's an incredible flight. Everybody gets off the aircraft with a big smile on their face. A lot of Vietnam veterans, our crew. So it's pretty amazing and a lot of healing. But we're there to educate the public, especially the youth. And it's... just an incredible feeling to know how many people appreciate those Hueys.
Well, I know I witnessed you guys up in Hamburg, Michigan.
Yes.
I think it was just last year. I got there too late to get the ride.
Yeah.
But
and then St. Joe on the coast, north of you.
Mm-hmm. No, so it's great. And hopefully maybe next summer you guys will be able to get out there again. And start offering the rides and do the whole thing.
Our season this year was cut short, obviously.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. I would say so. I'm going to take a real quick break right now. And when we come back, we're talking with Phil Marshall. His book is Helicopter Rescues in Vietnam. And we're going to start talking about some of those incredible rescues. So
perfect.
I want to make sure that you all stay tuned. You're listening to Veterans Radio, and we will be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Major Bruce Crandall made 14 flights into the Valley of Death, evacuating wounded. Details after this. Crandall made several routine flights into the Iodrang Valley in November of 1965, transporting a battalion of troops. Suddenly, the ground troops came under a massive attack from the NVA. On Crandall's next flight, three soldiers on board were killed and three wounded, but he remained in the line of fire so four wounded men could be loaded on his chopper. Crandall, along with Captain Ed Freeman, continued to make supply runs into the battle zone and airlift wounded out. During the course of the day, he flew three different choppers, with two of them so badly damaged they could no longer fly. At the end of the day, it evacuated 70 wounded men and brought in supplies which helped the battalion to survive. Freeman was awarded the Medal of Honor in July of 2001. President Bush awarded the Medal of Honor to Crandall on February 26, 2007.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Are you a veteran or a military spouse interested in starting or growing an existing business? Then you want to connect with VetBiz Central, Michigan's only veteran business resource center, providing free one-on-one business counseling services, including research plans and preparing veterans to be lender ready. If you're in business, VetBiz Central offers comprehensive strategic marketing strategies to help you connect to corporations. They are one of 20 centers nationwide devoted to veteran business development through the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Veteran Business Development. Vets helping vets. Visit their website at VetBizCentral.org or call 810-767-VETS.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Sky pilots.
here on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with Phil Marshall, the author of a series of books. We're on volume 12 right now of Helicopter Rescues in Vietnam, True Stories of Daring Helicopter Rescues, as told by the men who flew them. I don't even know where to start, Phil. So many of these.
Well, can I finish with one thing real quick, please?
Sure.
Talking about American Huey 369, we are building a Huey museum. It's not a Vietnam museum. It's, as far as we know, the only Huey museum in the world. And Bell Helicopter is not giving us not 1 cent of assistance. It's all grassroots. So if your audience would go to AmericanHuey369.com, tell you everything you need to know about the organization, about the museum that we're building. But right now we're in donated temporary housing, a hangar, and they tell us they're going to be tearing the building down here in the next year or two. So we're starting before we were really ready on building our Huey Museum. So donations are needed to complete it, and anyone that's interested in preserving our history and the history of the Huey, and of course what says Vietnam more than a Huey helicopter, it's really needed and much appreciated.
Absolutely, and we will do everything we can to help that out. We'll put a link on our website so that people
Great.
Can go and look about there on the AmericanHuey369.com. We need to preserve these aircraft, and as well as the museum, and they're talking about, you know, we got to go. I got to talk to Bell Helicopter. I mean, you know, that's ridiculous. I mean, considering. You know, how many of those things that
Thousands.
We did break a couple, but other than that, anyway. Well, maybe somebody listening may know somebody at Bell Helicopter, and maybe we can get the word out to those people to help out.
We don't have a corporate sponsor yet, and we're willing to include a corporate sponsor's name in the museum. So, like I say, we're going to build it. And we're breaking ground next spring, but it won't be complete. It's just going to be enough to house the current aircraft.
Well, like I said, Phil, we'll do what we can to raise some funds for you.
I'm sure you will.
I'm sure I will, too. So I want to talk. I have a friend who was I want to talk about one of your stories. And one of them that I thought was really interesting was about the Chinooks. Now, I never ran into too many Chinooks, luckily. And actually, the quick version of the story is the only place I ran into a Chinook was at a naval base called Na Bay down in Four Corps, where people would sometimes go for lunch because the Navy always had the best food.
Okay.
And it sounded like we worked a regular job. But when they'd say, go away, come back in half an hour. Anyway, we went down there, and there were Chinooks lined up, and there were gunships, and there were Hueys, and there were Navy sea wolves and all this other stuff all lined up to eat at this chow hall for the Navy. And out of one of the Chinooks came my TAC officer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. CW3 at the time, Berger, just looked at me, sort of recognized me. And I said, oh, Chief Berger, how are you doing? And he goes, oh, you're still alive.
Yeah, some of them we had doubts about, didn't we?
Yes, we did. And I said, well, it's good to see you too. moving right along. But anyhow, so I have a friend who was a crew chief on a Chinook, and one of your stories in here was about a Chinook, and I wondered if you could share that with our audience.
Okay, now which one are we talking about now?
Oh, which one? I knew you'd ask that question as I go through all
that. Yeah, cuz I've done a lot of Chinook stories.
Okay. I'll find it here as we talk.
Okay, because I'm looking too.
There's escape and evasion in Vietnam. Guy took a round through the helmet. Getting one over. All right, on radio you can never have silence. Oh, here we go. All right, so it's a sea night, and it is Mission 18, Marine ASRT flight, February 5th, 1969.
Yeah, Mr. Pratt.
Fred Pratt, correct.
Yeah. He was a Marine pilot, I believe, wasn't he?
Yes.
That make a difference. But they did some new tech radar, and this ASRT, guys, trying to remember what it stood for. Anyway, they were able to put them over a besieged Arvin base. They were able to drop supplies to them. They didn't see them. They didn't. They didn't. But this newfangled radar was able to put them miles away over this beleaguered Arvin base and resupply them, and they were able to defend off the enemy long enough to be rescued. But it was just something that had never been done before. And as a pilot, I don't know if I would want to trust something like that or not. But they just put them right over the – and they were in the mountains, by the way, too. They just put them right over the drop zone. They dropped the supplies to them, and they were able to survive the war, at least that battle.
Yeah, it was called the Air Support Radar Teams, and it would guide bombers for pinpoint ordnance delivery.
Yep.
And maybe you can tell the audience how much instrument training that we had as pilots.
Just enough to get ourselves killed. I don't know, what was it, 4 weeks of instrument training? And,
I think it was 4 weeks we would fly under in a hood. You know, we had this hood over our head.
Yeah.
That so we couldn't see the ground, couldn't see outside the aircraft.
Yeah, yeah. And it was enough to give you a little bit of confidence, but unless we practiced it often in country, which a lot of us rarely did, you would lose that skill, and you could very easily get vertigo, and both pilots could get vertigo, and it's all over when you get in that position.
Right, and you mentioned in the book that there were a lot of unfortunately helicopter crashes where people did get into IFR, that's instrument flying, situations where they did end up, you know, flying into a mountain or into each other, even, unfortunately.
Yeah, Your inner ear tells you one thing and the instruments tell you another, and you have to believe those instruments, but you know, for all your life, you've believed your inner ear. And when that conflict sets in, like I say, you're, as you well know, you're in big trouble, because you're so used to trusting your inner ear and the instruments are telling you something different. You don't want to believe it.
No, when I went through the, that was the hardest part of flight school for me, was that instrument flying.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. Yeah.
And they told me that, you know, even when we did the, what was it? Simulator, you know.
Oh, yeah. I hated that.
Where they would put us in this little shoebox type of thing with all the instruments in the aircraft. And then they would, you know, go this way and go that way and stuff. And I flew right off the edge of the earth.
It was a Link trainer, and it was left over from World War II.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but they needed pilots, and so this is what they got. I want to talk about, I don't want to run out of time here for sure. I want to talk about Charles Simmons. This is story number 22.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the reason I wanted to talk about this just real quickly is that there was another example that we had on Veterans Radio back in, oh boy, this is a long time ago now. We had a program called Left for Dead. And in this story, we had, it was actually a member of my company, but it was before I got there, and it was Wendell Skinner. And Wendell Skinner, on the night of 29 January, right around the same time, of 1968, when they aircraft crashed and the aircraft rolled over on Wendell. And he was left out there. And they all, you know, they went back because there was all kinds of gunfire and all this other stuff and smoke and ash and so on. Got back to the company area, and the company commander, who was a Major Earl Carlson, found out about that, and he just went through the roof. And he said, you know, you never leave anybody out on the field, whether they're dead or alive. You go and get them. And he went out and went out with a brand new Peter pilot and got Wendell. I mean, they were able to lift the aircraft off of him and bring him back. And they never saw each other ever again after that.
Yeah.
So that's the reason for the preface to this story of Charles Simmons. So go, your turn.
All right. First day of Tet, another B-model gunship. Charles Simmons is a trained crew chief. And his first day in the unit, they say, you're flying tomorrow. And so they put him as a door gunner in the B-model, and it was the first day of Tet. They get shot down. The enemy was about 40 or 50 troops where they landed. It was an emergency auto rotation, put the aircraft on the ground, no problem. Jumped into a bomb crater, the four crewmen, and held off the enemy as long as they could until they just finally ran out of ammunition. So they gave up. The enemy sets fire to the aircraft. The rockets start going off the ammunition, so everybody scatters. The co-pilot and the crew chief with one group of about half of that 40 or 50, the aircraft commander and the first day door gunner goes off with another group. When the cavalry shows up, another gunship from their platoon, about 30 minutes, an hour after they crashed, they see the bad guys and they start shooting at them. And the group of enemy that had the co-pilot and the crew chief executed them. The group that had the aircraft commander and the door gunner scattered while those two Americans dove into another bomb crater, put their hands over their head so the gunships would know not to shoot at them. And in the meantime, they're taking out the gunships are taking out as many of the enemy as they can. They land, pick up the two survivors, and they take them back. There's some minor injuries, so they're separated. And everybody forgets about this brand new guy that was his first day and only day of flying in Vietnam. He was relegated to the maintenance hangar. He said he worked on loaches his whole tour at night in the maintenance hangar. And so when the aircraft commander gets assigned to another unit, like you say, he never sees his door gunner. And after many, many years, a lady by the name of Kathy Cox, who is an officer in the Daughters of the American Revolution, found out about Charles Simmons, the door gunner, and they helped get him a prisoner of war medal because they were prisoners of war for about an hour. And so Kathy heard about me, and she asked me if I was interested in his story. And, of course, I was because they were rescued by helicopters. And American Huey 369 again, we had an event in August where we officially presented Mr. Simmons with his POW medal because he just received it in the mail. No citation, no letter, no nothing. Just a, here's your medal, whatever. And we made sure that there were about 30 men in uniform to salute him and honor him for his being a POW.
Well, the story is much. You're going to have to get the book, folks, to find out more about
it's
this.
It's a very involved story. There's so much more to what I told you. He couldn't talk about it to his family because he couldn't prove it. I was POW for an hour. I can't prove it.
So right, just, and who's going to believe that kind of story anyway?
Yeah.
And, but you had involved. You got, I think his name is Captain Bob Babcock.
Yeah, Captain Babcock. Babcock was the aircraft commander, and I asked him, he's living in Indonesia, I asked him, I said, do you know who the crew was that picked you up? And he goes, oh, yeah. He says, it was Wonder Warthog, Bob, or Tom Merline. And I said, well, do you know how to get a hold of him? And he says, well, he was killed during his second tour. And I go, well, crap, maybe I can find the co-pilot. So I'm writing the story for the book, and I decide, well, wonder what the story is on Merline being killed his second tour. And I looked him up in the Vietnam helicopter pilots directory, and the guy's living in New Jersey. the account of his demise was exaggerated. And so I was able to get part of the story, how they were picked up or how they picked up the POWs. And it's just an absolutely incredible story when you get all the details, how everything just happened to fit together.
Right, and I wanted to—I really wanted to congratulate you on this story because you tracked down the relatives of the crew chief, yeah. Delgado, and also of Warrant Officer Lee, the ones that were executed by the other group of North Vietnamese.
Yeah, DC or NVA, yeah. Well, Kathy Cox did a lot of that. She did a lot of that, and I was able to put it together and put it in print. Charles Simmons asked Kathy, could you help me tell my story? And when she heard about me, she says, yeah, I found somebody that'll tell your story. So Yeah, it was a lot of research on my part, but mostly on Kathy's part. She laid the groundwork, and I was able to put the finishing touches on it.
Well, it's a great story, and I encourage people to go out and get these books. You can start going backward with volume 12.
Helicopter Rescue. You can start anywhere. It's just like Reader's Digest, but there's no advertising in it.
You can start with books
if you want, and if you like it, you'll like all of them.
Yeah, I think that you will. I wanted to go back to one of my I don't know what my attraction is with Chinooks today. this would be Mission 9. It says it's called Mission into Laos.
Okay.
And this is a kind of a weather story, as we mentioned before, where they were setting up. They were attempting to. Now I don't even know how big a Chinook is. It's huge.
It's big.
And they were sent on this mission to pick up. Resupply.
To pick up some Marines.
Right.
And they wouldn't tell them where they were. They just said, go to these coordinates and you'll have some Marine gunships escort you. And as it turns out, they were in Laos. And in the very first book that I did, one of my medics told me about a pickup they made in Laos. He said there was no billboard saying welcome to Laos. We just knew that was where the down crew was, and they went after him. And when it was an Air Force, F4. And when they got back, the Air Force threw them a party, and the Army was going to give them an Article 15 for going into Laos. Go figure.
Well, so, I can understand
that. There was another instance where they just blindly followed the Marine gunships into Laos and had to drop down through a hole in the clouds to get their wounded.
I was thinking about that. Just a quick example was that we would – many of the missions of my company was to take we worked with LERPS and so forth with McVSOG, and so we would head off across the fence, as we used to call it.
Yep. Yep.
And as we would approach the fence, it seemed like almost daily some Air Force guy would come over guard radio, which was
Paris control.
Yeah, and they would say, aircraft heading west north out of Budop, be advised, you're crossing the fence.
Yeah.
And we're going, well, why don't you just tell them we're coming?
Yeah, because the bad guys did monitor our frequencies for sure.
And, you know, and if, anyway, that's the type of thing, you know, and as this story goes on, because they were going in and there were cloud cover, there was everything, and it kind of got in there somehow by going down through a hole in the clouds.
Yeah.
And we're able to fit this gigantic double wide trailer into this landing zone.
Yeah. It's as big as a semi trailer. And then after they picked those guys up, they thought the Marines were going to escort them back. And they said, oh, wait, we got another one for you. We need you to pick up some more.
And, yeah, but they don't. And they didn't have any guns on the second one.
I'm sorry.
I said they didn't have any guns on one of those.
No.
Because they ran out of fuel.
Yeah. Yeah.
As much as I love the guns, they always seem to run out of fuel at very inopportune times.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was getting close to happy hour, you know.
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah.
None of us know anything about that.
No.
I thought the mission in Laos was quite the story, and some of the other ones in here where you've got loaches flying around and. Again, for our audience, a loach it looks like an egg, but the thing could go fast, and it was almost indestructible.
It was incredibly maneuverable. Yeah.
And yeah. I had a friend who's
been one of the nice things about the books. It's not just Huey's; it's everything. There's a Pedro Air Force Pedro story, a couple of those in there. The loach rescues, the Chinooks, the Cobras. You can imagine Cobras pulling wounded guys out.
I know just, that. And like that, say, we did a story about a Cobra guy whose tail boom was blown off.
Yeah, missile. Yep, they got hit by a missile. That spoiler alert. That story will be in book number 15.
Oh, okay. And I think it's if you go to veteransradio.net and you look in the search thing, you might find the interview we did with the guy.
Brown, is that his name?
I believe so.
Yeah, I've known about that story for years, but it. it wasn't really a helicopter rescue, except they were rescued. So I guess that fits.
Well, because it was so unbelievable. Again, to our audience, to understand how these aircraft stayed in the air sometimes with missing parts.
The whole tail boom's gone.
You know, you would end up with so many bullet holes in the aircraft, but it would miss everything and missed all the crew and everything else. And you'd land, and it was almost like a Laurel and Hardy comedy where you'd land and almost the blades would just fall off.
Yeah. We lost half the helicopters that were in Vietnam.
Yes, true.
Half of them. Again, 6 months was the average Huey.
Wow. Six months.
Yeah, over 3,000 helicopters were lost during the war.
I think I've got that number around here somewhere too.
Yeah, Mike Law and Gary Roush from the VHPA have compiled all those numbers.
Right, they did, yep. And I do have that. I think it's I just want our audience to understand that these pilots that Phil is talking about. The average age was 22.
Well, if you remember, most of us were 19, 20, and 21.
Right. It was the old guys who brought the average up.
The older guys were the officers, the real live officers, the lieutenants and captains and majors that had some more training than what we had as far as the Army was concerned. Mm-hmm. Give me 60 seconds real quick to tell you a story.
Okay. You got it.
Okay. One of the 19-year-old pilots, you could go into flight school right out of high school. A year later, you're flying helicopters in Vietnam. This guy was from Southern California, 19 years old, 20 when he got back. And he says, I got my dress greens on, all my medals, my wings and everything. And he says, I realized my driver's license has expired. So he goes down to the DMV to get his driver's license renewed, and they wouldn't renew it because he wasn't 21. He had to go home and get his mother to sign for him.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me.
Can you believe that? But things like that are why 18-year-olds can vote today, because, as you know, we couldn't vote while we were in Vietnam unless we were 21. You had to be 21 to vote. But finally, Congress, one of the few right things they've done is if you're old enough to fight for your country, you should be old enough to vote. So that's why 18-year-olds can vote today, because we couldn't vote in Vietnam.
I was an older guy. I was 20. How old was I? I was 22.
I was 21 because I had a couple years of college.
Yes.
Yeah.
We won't go there.
Now, those 2 years of college weren't all A's and B's. I didn't have the grades to go back. They said maybe perhaps you should pursue another career.
You decided that you were going to become a helicopter pilot. And I know there are many similar stories out there, exactly that same thing. If you're like some of them, you probably might have sent a letter back to your school that wouldn't let you continue and say, this is what I did.
Yeah, I finally got my degree. It just doesn't say Ohio State on it.
Oh, well. Yeah. I won't go there either, since we live in Michigan now.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have mentioned that.
No, that's all right. I live in a house that is represented by both schools.
Oh,
so
okay. All right. That sounds like a personal problem to me.
We are coming up on the top of the hour now, Phil, and I want to make sure, again, that people understand that this is just one book of 20 approximate stories, and each one is more exciting than the other. And I would encourage our audience to go out and get these. And I'm assuming they are they available on Amazon? And
yes, they are on Amazon. If you just no special spellings, Phil Marshall Vietnam. If you search Phil Marshall Vietnam, all the books will come up, and just pick one out. And if you like it, you'll like all the others. I guarantee it.
I think they will, and again, I encourage people to read these stories, because these are amazing. I mean, the one of the things that the military taught me, and probably taught Phil and so many of the others, that the mutual respect we have for each other.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're on the ground or you're in the air, everybody had your six. I mean, everybody had your back, and it was all for one and one for all, and we never let anybody down if it could be avoided. And if we went down, they'd come and get us. And if they had ran into trouble, we would go and get them. And so I want to make sure our audience is aware of that.
And there are some of those stories in there too. And many of the stories that I've been able to document have never been printed anywhere else.
We just started doing a program here in Ann Arbor called There I Was. And we're trying to record as many stories as we can, get these guys, because suddenly we're the oldest generation now, and we got to make sure that we don't let these guys get away.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah.
So I want to thank you very much for being on our program, Phil, and I can't wait to have you back on again after I get a whole supply of my other books up to, up to 11.
I'll fix you up.
Okay, and we'll figure that out. But thanks very much for being on Veterans Radio, and maybe I'll see you down in Indiana soon.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right, folks. Well, we've come up to the end of another Veterans Radio program, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions for programming, please give us a call or send me an email to dale@veteransradio.net, and we will try to get them on. We want to thank you all very much for listening. We want to thank our sponsors, of course. And if you have any comments, please go to veteransradio.net and put them down there, and we will try to improve the program if you think it needs improving, or just let us know what you want us to do. Next week, Jim Fausone will be on. He's got two stories about women veterans, and I think that you'll find very interesting. So until next week, this is Dale Thronberry. You are dismissed.